Thanks so much, Noe. You know, the end of this year's legislative session is just weeks away. Still on the table is a proposal to eliminate a decades-old tax exemption on the investment trust that owns some of the most valuable real estate in Hawaii. Now, that idea has been opposed by those trusts known as REITs. Here's Chris Benjamin, CEO of Alexander & Baldwin, one of Hawaii's largest REITs.
The reason that imposing this tax would be a negative is that, first of all, it just is one more way in which Hawaii would be perceived as business unfriendly. I think that it would be a negative overall for the state. But more importantly, I think that it would almost certainly reduce REIT investment in Hawaii. I think that investment has been tremendously positive to the state.
But the idea of taxing does have supporters. Peter Savio is one of them. He's a real estate broker and affordable housing developer who spent his entire career in the Hawaii real estate business. He spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about why he thinks taxing REITs is a good idea.
I was here when the law first passed, and I remember the discussion about, is it going to hurt the state if we're collecting no taxes? And of course, back in the 60s, it was a completely different world. We didn't have as many large investors here in Hawaii. Everything was locally owned. Today, we're struggling to survive. Our taxes are getting higher. We don't have enough money for all the problems facing the community. And here we have a section of our business community that basically is tax-free. They were given an exemption in the federal tax code, which Hawaii adopted. We did not pass a law to allow this to happen. We just adopted the federal code and didn't give a lot of thought to what REITs would do over time. Because Hawaii has such a strong, such a unique market, all of our major assets, or most of our major assets, are REIT-owned. So you've got probably $18, $20 billion in asset owned by REITs. They're probably earning close to $1 billion, and they pay no state taxes. All of that revenue gets paid out in dividends to their stockholders. The stockholders may live on the mainland, a foreign country, and what happens is our taxes, our state taxes, are being sent to the mainland, and if they're in a tax-paying state, it's paid to that state. So Hawaii is a loser on this. So for us, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And we should tax the REITs the same as you tax a Hawaii corporation. We're not asking for a new tax. We're asking that they lose their exemption from paying state taxes.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit, because when we spoke with Chris Benjamin, the CEO of Alexander & Baldwin, which is one of the largest local REITs, he disputed some of that logic. For one, the lack of paying state taxes, he identified that they do in fact pay property taxes and GET. They're not paying income tax on profits, but those profits are being taxed at the individual income tax rate because they're distributed to the shareholders of the REIT. And so he referred to this type of idea as double taxation.
Not true. I want you to think about what he said and what you just said. They pay property taxes. They don't pay property taxes. The tenant who leases the space pays the tax. The tenant charges the consumer the tax. They're just the funnel through which it flows through. Okay? The gross income tax, it's the same thing. They don't pay it. The customer pays the tax. They just collect it and send it in. The tax that is collected is your income tax. I pay income tax. I own a hotel. I have to pay taxes on my hotel. The REIT owns the hotel next door. They pay no taxes. It's not fair.
Okay. But the hotel, the operator is paying, they're paying business income tax.
I'm paying business income tax. I'm paying every tax they pay, but they don't have to pay income tax, and I do. So the local guys are paying the income tax. The mainland REITs, the local REITs, do not have to pay the income tax. It's actually unfair in terms of what is happening, because if an insurance company bought that hotel, they'd have to pay an income tax. If a wealthy investor bought it, he would pay a tax. If any investor other than a REIT owned that hotel or that shopping center, they would have to pay the tax. So the REITs have an exemption, and they're fighting for the exemption because it's probably a decent size number.
One of the other points that was raised is that this is a big business in Hawaii, real estate development, commercial real estate development, and that instituting some kind of tax could potentially constrain that industry and cause developers to either not expand or not consider new projects, and that we would be hurt economically as a result?
Again, it's not true. I think it's a scare tactic they're using, try to get people to say, oh, yeah, we don't want to tax them. Again, all the local developers pay the income tax. All the mainland developers pay the income tax and develop. The only developers who don't pay the tax are the REITs. So again, other people are paying the tax, other people are succeeding, other people are able to do it. You know, the REITs have a really nice tax benefit. For the federal government, it works because the federal government actually gets a larger percentage of the revenue in federal taxes.
How okay. so?
Well, because the personal tax rate is higher than the corporate tax rate. So they're saying, okay, waive the corporate, pay us based on what the people are receiving.
But the burden is shifted to the individual rather than the corporation.
Well, but they get the money in the form of a higher dividend. So in Hawaii, we have the REITs are not paying any state tax. For the states, it doesn't work because the states lose the tax revenue. They don't get it back. And you only get it back if you own stock in REITs. But we have so much REIT investment, it's almost impossible for Hawaii to own enough REIT stock to get back the amount of money they're losing through waiving this tax or giving this exemption on the tax.
And as you pointed out, if the owner, a partial owner of a REIT, resides outside of Hawaii, then that tax is being paid in a different jurisdiction.
Correct. They receive the state tax as part of their dividend, and then they pay that tax in California or New York or somewhere else. Remember, a lot of states don't have state taxes. If they're federal or if they're foreign investors, they don't pay a state tax because they're in Canada or wherever. So this exemption is good for the REITs. It's good for the federal government. It's bad for a state like Hawaii, where we're a small state, but because of the strength of our economy, we have a very high percentage of REIT ownership. And that's what hurts us. Our market is so strong, so unique. I can assure you, if we pass this tax, they're not going to walk away. They're going to stay. They're going to invest. They're going to do everything else they want to do, because in the scheme of things, it's insignificant. They themselves say it's only $2 million. I want you to think about that. $2 million. Let's assume there's 100 REIT properties in Hawaii. That's $20,000 each. And they're telling you because of a $20,000 tax, the world's coming to an end. They're going to pull out of the state. We're going to lose jobs. $20,000 on a Hilton Hawaiian Village? $20,000 on an Ala Moana shopping center? If it really is only $2 million, what are we fighting about? It's not equal. It's not fair. I believe the number is actually much bigger. You're talking about REITs who earn $1 billion in income. And one state agency says it's only $2 million in taxes. Another state agency says it's $30 million in taxes. So, you know, you have a range of somewhere between 2 and 30. I believe the number is probably in the 30 million and up range. And it may not be the first year number. It may be after a while, because through the normal methods of avoiding taxes, depreciation, interest deduction, etc., over time, those numbers go down. But while they're going down, your income is going up with inflation. So eventually, REITs will start paying a much larger tax. That money for the state, our size, is a lot of money.
And $2 million is based on the analysis done by the State Department of Taxation.
Right.
This has not been tried anywhere else except New Hampshire, one state that has eliminated this income tax exemption. Why do you think that is? Why hasn't it been tried elsewhere?
I think because a lot of people don't think about it. A lot of states just adopted the federal tax code and didn't go through every provision and say, how does this impact us? I don't think other states have the same concentration of ownership we do. For a small state, it's devastating. It's interesting, New Hampshire, which is a small state, you know, withdrew. It's also interesting, you know, they tell you all these horrible things happen, but New Hampshire withdrew and they never had all the problems. REITs still invest in New Hampshire. They're still doing fine. They didn't repeal the law. You know, they're happy with changing the law. They're happy with receiving the income they're receiving. To me, it's about leveling the playing field. It's about making all corporations in Hawaii pay their fair share. The fact that the REITs are competing with local business that are tax-paying entities, to me, is not fair.
So even if it was only $2 million in additional revenue raise, if we take the low end of the projections, you think it's more of a social justice issue rather than simply a revenue issue?
Yeah, when they started to say it's only $2 million, one, I didn't believe the number. The Department of Business Development in the state says, no, it's closer to $30 million. So even within the state, they can't agree on the number. But the point being is it's not about the taxes. If it is $2 million, I want my $2 million for the state. If it's $30 million, I want the $30 million for the state. If it's neutral, that's fine. I still want equality. Okay, and it's just not fair to the local developers.
Peter Savio, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Peter Savio is a real estate developer and broker in Honolulu. He supports Senate Bill 301, which would tax the business profits of real estate investment trusts in Hawaii. If you want to hear more of the counterargument from A&B's Christopher Benjamin, you can find it on hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation, and I'm Catherine Cruz. Now, you know, you may not know that 30 years ago, the Bishop Museum was designated as the State Museum of Natural Collections, but there hasn't been established funding for it. The Hawaii Tourism Authority recently donated $50,000 to boost the program. The entomology collection is said to be the fifth largest in the country and one of the 10 best in the world. Think about that. The fly collection by itself contains 2 million flies. Now, we sat down with Chief Entomologist Neil Evanhus. He's been at the museum for the last 40 years and is a world specialist on moth flies. He shares with us that 2019 happens to be the year of the fly, but flies don't always get the credit they deserve. Do you know about cutie flies? Think Pokemon. Well, today we are showcasing Neil's insect research and that of his fellow scientists at Bishop Museum. It's timely because state lawmakers are taking up a bill to ensure that state funding for Bishop Museum is a priority. Neil Evanhus talks more about the museum's good work.
We have a checklist. We're the only state in the United States that actually knows an accurate number of how many plants and animals we have in Hawaii. There are others that sort of estimate, but we've actually searched the literature and keep up to date on that, and so we could tell you exactly how many of every different plant and animal that is occurring in Hawaii.
And your specialty happens to be flies.
It is flies, yes. And it's the year of the fly this year, 2019. We had a congress of fly workers called Dipterological Congress every 4 years, and the last one was in Namibia last November. And so last year, 2018, was the year of the bird, and this year is the year of the fly. The things that I work on, I'm the world specialist on bee flies, which are they pollinate various flowers. They're commonly found in deserts, so we don't see them too much in Hawaii. In fact, we only have one species in Hawaii that's introduced from Taiwan, and they're all parasites. The one in Hawaii is parasitic on mud dauber wasps, and came in 1955 and slowly went from one island to another, and now it's like any other introduced species. It sort of peaks in population, so you get a number of sightings, and then it sort of declined, and right now it's still out there, but you don't hear from it too much. But I still work with a bunch of researchers who also work on bee flies. They're still found on Oahu, and I think there's records on Maui and in the Big Island. So I'm not sure about Molokai and Kauai, but still getting records from the other islands. But it could also be that they're there, but just in really low numbers and people aren't seeing them as much. They usually like to be in open, dry areas, and so they're not going to be in the forest as much as, say, if you're on the Big Island, it's going to be on the Kona side and not on the Hilo side.
So now when people think of flies, they probably think of, ew, get them out of here.
They do. That's something that I just had to live with when I chose the group that I was going to work on when I was in college. But I didn't think about that when I was working on with my major professor at the time, who was a bee fly expert. And so I was always interested in entomology and never thought that I'd be working on flies, but he got me interested just because of the pollination aspect. I really liked the working on the biologies of the insects that were pollinating the flowers in the deserts. And these are kind of cute. There's, in fact, not when you think of flies, you think of yucky flies that bother you at picnics, or, you know, mosquitoes are flies too, and so they're kind of yucky. But these guys, some of them can be rather cute. They're little fuzzy puffballs, and one of them is even on a Pokemon deck. It's cutie fly. So if your listeners Googled cutie fly and looked at the images there, you'd see actually the Pokemon cutie fly, and right next to it is an existing bee fly that it was based on, which is found in Japan. And the publicity for that actually got the conservationists interested in conserving the species in Japan of that species. It's the scientific name is Anastichus nitidulus. It's just a little puffball, little fuzzy puffball, yellow with a little proboscis sticking out that sucks nectar from plants.
And so we talked about how up at Haleakala they've got silver swords and special flies that pollinate those special plants.
So the silver swords have a whole number of pollinators of flies that are in a group that are associated with the silver swords and keep those silver swords pollinated and thriving. And there's also another fly that we're going to be, I have an article that's going to be going into our members' newsletter, Ka'alele, and the title's going to be, "Do you like chocolate? Well, thank a fly," because without this particular fly that we have in Hawaii, we wouldn't have any chocolate being grown in Hawaii. And we have a business now starting up with chocolate in Hawaii. You know, there's chocolate in other areas, but they've started up a while ago and is starting actually to thrive now here. They've got some businesses going. And if it wasn't for that fly, the cacao flowers could not get pollinated. It's a unique mechanism that apparently the fly has to know how to get inside the flower and get the pollen, and then it goes to another flower and pollinates that. And so the cacao flowers then produce the cacao pods when you get the chocolate from that.
So I imagine, though, we didn't really have a cacao industry going, but we've had these flies here. So when the cacao plants aren't around, how do they survive? What do they eat?
Well, they're generalist, and we group things into families and genera and species. And this particular genus, which doesn't have a Hawaiian name, but the genus is Forsyth amaya, and it's found in the tropical areas all over the world. And there are other species that pollinate the cacao flowers in other tropical regions of the world. So that's why chocolate is able to grow in other parts of the world as well. And here in Hawaii, it's just unique that we happen to have the species that pollinates the cacao here is endemic. It's only found in Hawaii and nowhere else. And it was described by one of our Bishop Museum staff members in the 1980s. And it's named after my major professor at University of Hawaii. So it's called Forsyth amaya hardii.
And it's named after?
It was named after Elma Hardy, who was my former professor at the University of Hawaii. What we're going to be doing as part of this Hawaii Tourism Authority contract is, in addition to updating our checklists, the ferns are going to be updated and the Hawaiian flies are going to be updated. We're doing some public outreach things, and one of them is going to be putting displays up in the Science Adventure Center. So there's going to be three different flies that are going to be portrayed in three different ferns. We're doing them every other month, going on for a whole year, so you'll get six different ones. And the first one that's going up is going to be a moth fly. That's something that's, when you see it, you'll think it looks like a moth, and then it's really a fly. So a little story go along with those. I'm picking things that, again, when people think of flies, they think of a certain image in their mind, and I'm trying to show the public that there's a lot more different types of flies that are out there. The chocolate midge that I was talking about is going to be an article in the Ka'alele. And some of the other displays that we're going to be doing, I haven't really chosen what's going to go up after the moth fly, but there's going to be some interesting things there. So people that come to the museum, you know, come every other month so you can see those displays. They'll be changing. We're the State Museum of Cultural and Natural History, and in the Hawaii Biological Survey, we maintain the checklists of all the species that occur in Hawaii, but we're never getting any funding from the state to specifically do those things. We get an appropriation from the state every year, but there was nothing specifically going to Hawaii Biological Survey to help us update those things. So this is really the first time that we're getting some money that's specifically directed at updating those checklists, and we also have in the works a grant and aid from the state. And with the HTA, they require public outreach, and so something that does benefit the visitor, or in this case, it's with the Aloha Aina program, which is telling stories of Hawaii is what we're going to be doing, which is promoting are fostering an appreciation for our natural resources. So what we'll do with the public aspect of this is the garden tours and also these displays and articles in the newsletters that sort of hopefully the readers and visitors will have a greater appreciation for the natural resources that exist in Hawaii. The entomology collection, I should say, is the fifth largest in the country and in the top 10 in the world, just in size also. We have around 17 million specimens in our collection, and of those, 2 million are flies. I was involved when I first started at the museum many moons ago, working on mosquitoes. And we have a huge collection of mosquitoes because of a lot of funding that took place on doing just that, working on the mosquitoes. And so we have this fantastic collection of mosquitoes over time where they all occurred. So that's why we could say that the Aedes aegypti stopped in 1970, because we have all those collections that show that.
Marvelous collections they have there. That was entomologist Neil Evanhuis, a cutie fly guy, passionate about his work and that of his colleagues at the Bishop Museum. You know, it's time now for our reality check. Joining us is Honolulu Civil Beat's education reporter, Sue Von Lee. She has a story about an audit and the fees that are charged to developers to help build new public schools. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So I know we've had this concept of impact fees, but tell us more about this audit.
Yeah, sure. So this is a self-initiated audit by the State Auditor's Office, and this was recently presented to the Hawaii Board of Education at their last meeting. Apparently, it's been underway since February. So what's interesting about this audit is that it came from within the Auditor's Office itself. Oftentimes, Hawaii audits are directed by the state legislature, but in this case, State Auditor Les Kondo told the board that he self-initiated this audit to come up with recommendations to the DOE to see how it could better implement the school fees impact program.
Well, I know that the whole impact fee concept, you know, we were doing that way back when they were building all these golf courses, that the community felt we ought to have some kind of fee to offset the impact to our community. And there's been lots of interest with the impact fees, particularly with rail coming into town.
Absolutely. School impact fees, for those who aren't familiar with them, were established by the legislature in 2007. So the concept has been around for quite some time. Now, what might interest our Oahu readers is that the Ala Moana to Kalihi track, which kind of does track that Honolulu Rail Project station line, is the latest school impact district identified by the DOE. So the fees for that area came into effect on October 1st of last year. So developers who are applying for building permits for residential units in that area are going to have to pay these fees. There are some exceptions, affordable housing not included. The idea behind the school impact fees really is to allow the residential developers to pay fees in these high impact areas, because if you're building buildings, residential buildings, then the idea is that student enrollment in those areas is going to grow. So they ought to offset some of these expansion costs or building new school facilities costs is the idea behind the impact fees.
Well, I know that for Kaka'ako, there was a concern that the elementary schools were going to get tapped pretty quick.
Right, and Kaka'ako, as we know, is hugely rapidly developing. Even some affordable housing units in that area, too, are really coming up on the rise. So I think people are watching to see, the implementation behind this fees program. As we see development in that region, as we see, what's going on with HART and the rail project, I mean, all these things are sort of now colliding, or rather the DOE's plans for new schools, even a vertical school in the works. I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens. And going back to the audit with the school impact fees program, the auditor said that he really was trying to come up with recommendations for the DOE to see what implementation of this project could be better better conducted. I think there's still more planning to be done at this point, but we're expecting a report sometime in June is what he said.
Okay, well, we'll be anxiously awaiting the results of that. But thanks so much, Suvan.
Sure thing. Thank you.
That was our reality check featuring education reporter Suvan Lee. You can read the entire story online at civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, performing music of Debussy, Weber, and Rimsky-Korsakov, featuring clarinetist David Chifrin this Saturday and Sunday at the Blaisdell. HawaiiSymphonyOrchestra.org.
We've been inviting newsmakers to the table to talk one-on-one with our listeners. Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell joined us back in February to tackle some of the top-of-mind issues, including the enforcement or lack of enforcement of zoning laws. Caldwell spoke to the complexity of transit vacation units, or TVUs, and legal B&Bs, and his efforts to manage runaway vacation rentals here in Honolulu.
This is an issue that every county struggles with and the state struggles with. And so, you know, a while ago, we put together a working group, all kinds of folks from Airbnb folks to traditional hotel folks, everyone in between. And we asked for their input to come up with a recommended way to regulate this industry. And through their hard work, last year, at the end of the year, I introduced a bill. It's Bill 89 that's comprehensive in terms of trying to address this issue from all sides. And I'm just making it clear, as mayor, I'm not trying to shut down vacation rentals, eliminate them altogether. But how do we regulate it? How do we find the balance? How do we address the impacts it's having in our neighborhoods around our island? You know, if there's 15 to 20,000 illegal vacation rentals, and we have 30,000 or so hotel rooms in Waikiki, and we have Lyft like never before, the number of flights coming in here, if we eliminated this industry altogether, Lyft would drop dramatically. It'd probably have an impact on the overall health of our economy, being tourism our number one industry. So having said that, how do we find this balance? And what this bill does is, and this is very rough numbers, it would probably allow approximately 4,000 to 5,000 vacation rentals, whether it be single family homes in certain very limited areas or B&Bs around the island. 4,000 from 15,000 to 20,000 is a huge drop. But it's a starting point. Now, the council may disagree and want a higher number. I don't want to kill our tourism industry. I want to find balance. And you know, I think the magic of this bill, it does set limits of where you can have these things. Single-family homes that are vacation rentals, you cannot have in any residential neighborhood anywhere on this island should this bill pass. So along the North Shore, along Kailua, along the Kohala area, West Side, if they're a home, a single-family home, you would not be able to operate it as a vacation rental. Limited numbers in resort areas, Ko'olina, those kind of places, Turtle Bay, you would be permitted. And then on B&Bs, a number of them, you could still have them. They're hosted, so the impact is less. That means a local family is living in the home where you'd maybe be renting a room or another person renting a room, up to two rooms max. And we've reduced that number, too. When I put in the bill initially before the Planning Commission, it would allow it as many as you want. And we heard from the community. I had to go back to the Planning Commission and say, I'm open to compromise. Let's reduce the number of B&Bs. Let's get the bill to the council so they can start to get the hearing. So it really regulates and allows them only in certain areas. But here's the other magic of the bill, enforcement. You know, we could hire 1,000 inspectors and they'd be out there inspecting every day, because even when you catch someone one time, doesn't mean they're going to stop, because if you're making 10 to 20,000 a month on your home, there's a lot of incentive to do it again, get caught again, do it again, get caught again. And you can't, it's hard to catch people. You got to catch them in the act. You have to have them admit that, yes, I'm renting this place. So there's a lot of fact-driven scenarios. And we do catch people. A lot of times they'll take us to court and the judge splits the baby in half and they come back and do it again. So the enforcement is you need to get a registration number. And with that registration number, you must put it on all your advertisements. As you know, these are all hosted sites. If it doesn't have the number, it's a prima facie case that you're operating an illegal vacation rental, and you'll be fined $25,000 a first-time infraction, $50,000 a second time, $100,000 a third time. We put a lien on your property, we execute on the lien, and you lose your home. It is draconian, it is very harsh, but we believe that it'll be easy to catch them because they have to advertise on social media sites. We'll probably work with a third party to find these places that are illegal, pinpoint who's doing it, and we find the homeowner, and then we take their home. We think it'll bring discipline. People will get the registration number and comply with the law.
And, you know, critics say enforcement is key because we haven't been able to enforce over the last 30 years, and that's why we're in this situation today.
Correct.
And we've seen a lot of the sentiment about tourism kind of go south because of all the impacts on our trails and our parks and our neighborhoods.
Yes.
And so folks are saying, well, then why not change the laws to make sure that we can do a better job at enforcing?
Right. So we want to know, are you doing it? You got to get a registration number. You give us all the information. We get that information, and now we know who's legal. Anyone else is illegal. If you're on a hosted site with Airbnb or BRBO or any of those places and you don't have your registration number, we're coming after you. Easy to get you. You're going to be fined. You're going to be punished. We think it'll stop the bad actors. It's kind of like catching someone speeding. You got to be there when they're speeding. Calling and saying, I saw someone speeding down the highway, and the police go and they're not there anymore, they're not speeding, you can't do anything about it.
You know, Mayor, I know I went to an open house at a home in Palolo, and I was there with another family, just happened to walk in at the same time, and I heard the realtor say, oh, you know, this place is already set up. You can just build a wall here, and then you can have two units, and you can do whatever you want. You can make it into an Airbnb or a rental. And this was the realtor talking, yeah, telling prospective customers, you know. And so it was just really disheartening, yeah, to hear that.
So to address that, I mean, along with this omnibus bill, we put two other bills in with this bill. One is requiring that when you sell a home, you have to disclose that this is not a vacation rental is not permitted here. Just like you have to do a lead paint disclosure and all these different disclosures, it's another way to inform, making the realtor comply with the law and tell the purchaser you cannot do a vacation rental. The other one is a bill to make it a criminal offense if you lied to an inspector. You know, when you knock on a door and they say, no, we're not doing a vacation rental, and then it's how do you prove that they're not? If they lie and we prove that they are doing one, then they are criminally on the line, and we're hoping that will create some fear and that people will not lie. That's part of this package of bills.
Okay, well, we have a couple of calls, yeah, on the line. Caller from Kaimuki, Carol, you have a question for Honolulu's mayor?
Yeah, I just have a quick statement. It's just a sense of, in relation to the Department of Planning and Permitting, we have a monster house situation, of course, we all know, in Kaimuki and all these other areas. But it would be great to have the head of the Department of Planning and Permitting have a real sit-down with folks, and then also to have each of the inspectors that we have on staff sort of assessed for what they've been doing, basically, or for lack of a better word, over the last couple years. We've found that a lack of sympathy and a general sense of apathy with neighborhood complaints and even just updates that have been given to our DPP inspectors. They need definitely more people on force, and they basically, I think, would also do well to have an assessment from up above to see how it's all filtering down to really what's happening in our neighborhood.
That's a good point, Mayor.
Yeah. No, and I mean, I'm not opposed to having a sit down with a representatives from different communities, however that is determined. I can assure you that the director of Department of Planning and Permitting is intimately familiar because she's had to go before the council numerous times, and you know she's been beat up pretty badly for what's occurred. Now, there is a moratorium. There should not be any more large-scale homes, detached homes being built. There were permits issued because part of the problem, the way our law was written, it allowed for this. I mean, inspectors go out, but they inspect for the law in place. And unfortunately, the way the law was written, it was so broad that it allowed these larger homes to be built, which are really negatively impacting our communities. I agree with you, Hunter, and I'd be totally upset if one was built next to me. We have stopped it. You can't come down and get a permit today. Now, if someone tries to build one without the permit, that's a whole nother issue. And the council has recently really increased the fines for doing that kind of thing, including making the person tear down what they built. But there are a number that are going through the process that got their permit previously that may be some of the things you're dealing with. In the future, I think this moratorium should stay in place. There should be no large homes allowed on smaller lots. And again, under the bill we just submitted to the Planning Commission, to take that energy that's there and do it in apartment zoned areas where these kind of projects won't have the negative impact you're experiencing. I think you said in Kaimuki, Carol. But I'll take this back to DPP, and maybe there's a way to reach out. If there's an organization or something of community communities that are dealing with this to come in and talk, we'd be more than happy to listen.
You've been hearing from Mayor Kirk Caldwell, and that was an excerpt from a call-in show originally aired in February. Our listeners were given the opportunity to talk directly with local newsmakers from across the state. Just one example of some of the new things we're trying here on The Conversation. And that's it for our show today. Now back over to Pledge Central.